WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and now another of our conversations looking back at the 2000s, the aughts, the noughts, or whatever you want to call them. In a moment, we'll meet Michael Schaefer, who just wrote a piece in Obit magazine about what he calls the bunker decade. But first, a quick montage, about a minute, to remind you of some of the events from the aughts that had us retreating into bunkers, both literal and metaphorical.
With all the talk of Y2K bugs and Y2K terrorists, well now, Y2K hackers ready to attack computers all over the place at midnight Friday.
Good evening. Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
There is no question now that John Gagan's superiors in the Catholic Church knew for decades he was a child molester.
We're already getting some pretty significant winds here in New Orleans and some significant rain as well as the first squalls from Hurricane Katrina start to batter the Big Easy.
Wall Street itself is a abstraction. There are many people who made big mistakes and many regulators who made mistakes, and we need to figure out what those were and make sure they don't happen again.
There are those who suggest that Afghanistan is another Vietnam. They argue that it cannot be stabilized, and we're better off cutting our losses and rapidly withdrawing. I believe this argument depends on a false reading of history.
Y2K, Bush versus Gore, 9/11, Axis of Evil, Catholic Church scandal, Katrina, the financial meltdown, and, of course, the continued war in Afghanistan. No wonder Michael Schaefer thinks we spent the decade searching for the nearest bunker. He joins us now. His latest piece is in Obit magazine, labeling this the bunker decade. You can find a link on our webpage. Hi, Michael. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we'll talk about being disappointed in big institutions in a minute, but what do you mean by the bunker decade?
You know, I feel like the nature of life in the last decade, insofar as you can generalize, was that we retreated. We didn't all of the institutions that we were supposed to trust to protect us from environmental calamities, protect us from hurricanes, to protect us from terrorism, to protect us from presidents who go to war under false pretenses, kind of let us down. And I think that the reaction on the part of a lot of people was to just sort of bunker down at home, bunker down in their little community of people who see the world in the same way they do, and kind of look out at them, all these scary, menacing figures out there. And there sure were a lot of them in the last 10 years.
Who would you identify as the big thems? I guess we could think of a few off the top of our head, but who did you have in mind?
Well, you know, I think it really depends on who you are. I mean, you know, for almost all Americans, the them is there's foreign terrorists. For a lot of us, it's Wall Street. For some of us, it's the religious right. It's right wingers, or it's left wingers, or it's liberals, or it's Hollywood. And I think this was a decade of where technology kind of made it easier and easier and easier for us to gather together with like-minded people. And the tendency at that point was to sort of look out at these thems. Some of them are phantoms that we make up. Some of them we attribute powers to that they don't actually have. But in all cases, it's this kind of them against us feeling.
the liberals, the Republicans, the Muslims, the immigrants, the neocons, the gays, the Bible thumpers, the climate scientists, Goldman Sachs.
All of them. And you know, it, obviously, who you're them is going to depend on who you are. But, you know, they said the 70s was the me decade. I think this is this bunker decade we've had. This was sort of the they decade. We really focused and demonized, and in a lot of cases accurately, this other who were threatening us.
Listeners, we have time for a few calls from Michael Schaefer on his theory that this is the bunker decade or the them decade. If so, how do we make the 20-teens the us decade? 212-433-WNYC. Do you like this framing of the decade that we've just lived through? Is it useful for understanding who we've become as a nation, as a world? 212-433-9692. You obviously don't like this trend. Do you blame anybody?
You know, I think you can probably blame a lot of bad actors. I don't think, you know, I don't think George Bush and Dick Cheney really did their country a huge number of favors. But I think some of it is also just the kind of inevitable result of technological change. I don't think we were going to, with the ability we all have to kind of navigate our media, I don't think it was going to stay the way it had been, where kind of everyone got their news or their opinion from the same places. That just wasn't going to be the case anymore, no matter who was running the show. And I think there is a natural tendency we have as humans to kind of gather with like-minded people.
Used to be that everybody got their news from the same three places and everyone was dissatisfied with them. Now we all get our news from a million different little cloistered places, but we like them better.
Right. And, you know, at Obit, we write about transitions a lot, and we write about people who have died. And I remember at last summer when Walter Cronkite died, there was all this kind of breastfeeding of, you know, who will we trust now, and Uncle Walter. And you know, I think people kind of chalked it up to his personal virtues, when actually I think you can make a much better case that the reason he was so trusted was the nature of the media he, you know, sat on top of in the 60s and 70s. And no matter how good a guy he is, he wouldn't have had the same sort of position in our society now.
And, you know, we try to bridge that gap here a little bit and welcome people from across the spectrum in and actually have conversations with each other. But one of your main arguments is that this was a decade in which big institutions continuously let us down by not being up to the challenges presented to them. And it's easy to think of so many of what they might have been, the FBI and the CIA and Wall Street and the Army Corps of Engineers. Is there a theme to this, or does it just kind of come in a cluster of big institution failure coincidences?
I think that for 30 or 40 years, I mean, we've had a kind of a political battles in our country over institutions. How much should we trust them, and so on. And I think one of the things that happened during the last decade was that really that ended, and there was a. It's been pretty well established. Most people think that you shouldn't just blindly trust an institution. And people will say, "Gee, you know, insurance, you know, doctors who are suggesting we do this, they're actually in it for the money," or a media report about something is actually because of their ideology. During the build-up to the Iraq War, when military brass were saying, "Hey, we need more troops than Rumsfeld is assigning," there was a natural reaction on part of Iraq War supporters to say, "Oh, that's just a bunch of feather-bedding military bureaucrats. Of course, that's what they're going to say, because the more soldiers they have, the more power they have." And it was this, you know, and that was on the right, and the people who are supposed to be pro-military, kind of to a fault. So I think that this is not necessarily a bad thing, but we do tend to look more skeptically at institutions, and the institutions gave us a lot of reason to look skeptically at them in this last decade, including, you know, I'm a reporter. The institution I'm a part of did not exactly cover itself with glory.
No doubt. Anita in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anita.
Yes, hi. I think he's right on the nose, but I'd like to apply it to a different area, and that is to the family. And who are the they within the family now? The family unit, as small as it is in the United States, has gotten, I think, further desiccated, because you're pitting one generation against the other. The older generation, which was protected by Social Security, which meant something, and other protections, is now that's not sufficient. so the younger generation has a bigger burden on it in relation to the older generation, and which prevents them from flowering the way they would like to. So that I think we should look and see how this phenomenon works within the family.
And at the same time, that you could say there's a bunker mentality and people wanting to not even live multi-generationally.
Yes.
They want to live in the nuclear family and independence, which a lot of older people may want because they want it and it's a positive value. Other people just don't want the burden of them.
Right.
So I don't know if you have anything to say about that, Michael, but Anita brings up a whole other interesting array of issues there connected to family and bunkers.
You know, I mean, I don't think anyone who's in a family needs to be told that economic stress has a way of really messing with the dynamics and creating a lot of tension inside the family itself. So you know, absolutely, we really do see a lot of tension.
Fred in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to say I talked to a screener and. I don't know how to phrase it, but, you know, in the Yeats poem where he says, in the end, the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passion and intensity. And I think that if you want to take Obama as being the best, I think really what you have to say is that the passion and intensity of the worst is so strong to overcome. And you know, it's kind of in the same vein as what your guest has been saying about, you know, hunkering down and... And there have been so many times where we had opportunities for people who wanted to do good. And when I say doing good, I don't mean in a subjective way, but I mean in a way that would be universal to everyone. And what we ended up doing as a society, I think, is just following these narrow paths that certain, demagoguery leaders, whether they be religious, political, or otherwise, have come along. And you know, I'm not really a religious person, but I remember this poem from a book by Joan Didion when she slouching towards Bethlehem, when she paraphrased Yeats, and nothing more clearly represents in my mind what's going on in our society and for that matter in the world. There are so many people that want to do good, but for some reason, and I can't figure it out, the people that their results would be bad for everyone. Are the ones that are heard the loudest, and that's just what I think.
And poetry lives in Queens, as Fred calls up and cites both Yeats and Joan Didion. And Fred, you'll be interested to know that from our literary quick strike research force that we have across the glass from me, we have confirmed that the quote is, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity," just like you said it, and that it's from The Second Coming by Yeats, a poem from 1919.
Right.
And, Michael, it certainly does seem an apt, at least second half of that Yeats line, "The worst are full of passionate intensity," relating to your theme of the bunker decade or the them decade.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that we're really thinking about a lot this fall as the healthcare debate has gone on is that in our system there are a lot of points where people can stop things, where it's you know, you can have 60 votes in the Senate and that's not enough. You can have all sorts of public support and that's not enough. There are a lot of stop points. That was intentional by the people who wrote the Constitution to make a sort of conservative society that was very hard to effect big change in. But what we're seeing, as he said, is that it means that an intense few, a few that you or I may think of as kind of anathema, can really throw a monkey wrench into the system too. And it gives it I think makes people doubt even, you know, gee, is this country governable? I mean, that's sort of the thing I've been hearing a lot lately. So this thing that I think most Americans are most proud of in the world, our constitution, our government, our democracy, I think is not really acquitting itself especially well right now. And that's not to say the alternative is any better, but it's just to say that in the kind of spirit of the times where I feel like we've lost a great deal of faith in things that institutions that are supposed to keep us going, that's one of them.
Let's get one more caller in. Kyle in Milburn wants to build on the phrase "the bunker decade," right, Kyle?
Yeah, I find myself hunkering down, particularly after 9/11. I stopped watching network news programs, and this last election cycle in 2008, I found myself just you know, watching and reading the things that I agreed with. So I agreed with your guest in that regard.
Hunkering down. So it's the hunker and bunker decade.
The hunker decade. I just hunkered in my house and didn't branch out. I do listen to NPR headline news, and that's when I, you know, started doing that religiously after 9/11. But the network shows, I can't even stand to watch anymore.
Kyle, thank you for your call. Michael, before you go, you're a freelance writer who's done a lot of different kinds of work. This article about the Hunker Decade or the Them Decade is in Obit magazine, just so people
right.
know before you go. But we can't let you go with asking about your latest book, One Nation Underdog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. So how does the world of obsessive dog owners fit into the story of the last decade?
Well, you know, the book I wrote actually is about how normal dog owners and normal cat owners are now doing things that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago would have looked completely crazy. And I, you know, I got a dog, and I'd never had a dog before. And sort of like a lot of people entering a new situation, I looked around at my friends and neighbors and sort of did what they did. And all of a sudden, my in-laws and so on are saying, "What, you're feeding it organic pet food, and you hired a trainer?" And these are all things where I live are pretty ordinary. And I think that people have, you know, promoted their pets, especially dogs, to becoming full-fledged members of the family with everything that comes with that. And you then see a lot of our changes in the way we think of families and the way we think of all the things you do in a family, like educate and nurture and care for. You see those changes all in the way we care for pets. And these things that people say are kind of crazy pet person things to do are actually pretty normal reactions to our current society. And I would say, you know, based on the bunker decade thing that we've been talking about, that one theory for why people have become so much more intensely attached to their pets is that this trend kind of took off just at the same time historically in the last 20 or 30 years as divorce went up, as people moved to more far-flung, sprawling suburbs away from tight-knit neighborhoods, as people became more lonely. They in turn kind of elevated their pets to give them a degree of social support that humans didn't used to give them. And we see the results now. Some of them are sort of goofy looking, but a lot of them are really sweet.
And Michael will give the last word to Brandon on our comments page, who wrote, "Given the prevalent influence of Fox News, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, maybe it's the Archie Bunker decade."
So, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. The Bunker Decade on Obit Magazine.
Brian
Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll get a report from Stove Camp coming up next.